Welcome to God and Country Biblical Exposition. Last week I had a table set up and I spoke at Bridgefest, a Christian event by the ocean at the old Tabernacle Camp Meeting in Ocean Grove, New Jersey. I was planning to post a video of my presentation, but my camera settings were accidentally moved, so the footage was unacceptable. But I was able to capture some audio, and hopefully I'll have that up soon on my website, godandcountryradio.org. The program for this week and for next week, part one and two, was about Israel. With everything going on in the news, I didn't have time to address the Israeli war with Iran. It happened quickly. It's now being called the 12-day war, just like in 1967, there was the 6-day war. To organize a discussion, I've divided the material into 8 observations about Israel and the Israeli-Iranian war. Some of these points may be well-known to Christians, others may be new, but they are truths that every Christian needs to know in discerning the signs of the time and Israel's place in prophecy. The first point is well-known, but let's revisit it to make sure we fully understand it. The state of Israel is a sign in God's prophetic timetable. During the Passion Week, on the way to Jerusalem, Jesus cursed the fig tree. Matthew 21:19, seeing a lone fig tree by the road, he came to it and found nothing on it except leaves only. And he said to it, "No longer shall there ever be fruit from you." And at once the fig tree withered. This was a very unusual miracle performed by Jesus, very much out of character with all the other miracles. This is the only miracle that was meant to destroy something rather than to heal something. And it seems pretty petty. Unless Jesus had a vindictive spirit toward fruit trees that didn't provide him any fruit, we really do have to consider a deeper meaning. And the meaning is obvious to anyone who knows the Bible. The fig tree represents Israel. It was Israel that was giving the appearance of fruit, or rather works for God, but had not. And Israel bore no fruit at a time when she was to be bearing fruit. Specifically, the nation did not receive the Messiah and his kingdom. The Jews themselves did not recognize the time of their visitation by God, Luke chapter 19. And there in Luke chapter 19, we see Jesus cursing the nation of Israel itself, which of course the cursing of the fig tree was a sign and symbol. And the curse was also pronounced in Luke chapter 13, verse 35. Jesus said, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together, just as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not have it. Behold, your house is left to you desolate. And I say to you, you will not see me until the time comes when you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" It is a serious offense and a sign of an evil heart to reject God when he reveals himself to you. But notice the hope that Jesus extends. When you change your attitude and receive the Messiah, when you say, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord," the praise and the honor toward the Messiah sung in Psalm 118:26, then you'll see Jesus again. And Jesus' words in Luke 13 become a prophecy that in the last days many Jews will return to the Messiah, and then the Messiah will return. Now, today, Orthodox Jews believe that if the Jewish people finally keep all of the law of Moses, then the Messiah will arrive, because then the Jews are good enough. But no, the Messiah will arrive only when the Jews turn to Jesus Christ as their Savior from sin. But back to the fig tree. Old Testament passages clearly depict the nation of Israel as symbolized by a fig tree, such as Hosea chapter 9, verse 10. "I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your forefathers, as the earliest fruit on the fig tree in its first season. The symbol of the fig tree continues on in Jesus' prophecy, because during the Passion Week, Jesus' final week, the disciples ask him, what will be the sign of his coming, of his return to set up his kingdom? Then Jesus gives the signs preceding the coming, a great tribulation, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Jesus then emphasizes that there will be signs preceding his coming. And the fig tree is the illustration. Just as a sign that summer is near is a fig tree putting forth leaves, the signs just mentioned by Jesus are signs of his soon return. Matthew 24:32. Now learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So you too, when you see all of these things, recognize that he is near, right at the door. The fact that Jesus again mentions the fig tree is significant. If it's obvious that the cursing of the fig tree earlier in the week represents Israel, and Jesus' reference to the fig tree in his Olivet discourse was not random, it also likely represents Israel. Not Israel's curse, but Israel coming back to life as a sign of Christ's soon return. Besides, Jesus' words, when you see all of these things, refer back to events in Israel. When you see the abomination of desolation in the temple, when you see a great tribulation. And in the book of the Revelation, we see that the events preceding the coming of Christ will be 144,000 Jews coming to faith and two prophets prophesying in Jerusalem at the temple. Now, throughout the 20th century, with the renewed interest in biblical prophecy and a literal interpretation of prophecy, this interpretation of Matthew 24:32 was a given. But recently, among some Christians, there has been a rise in an anti-Israeli sentiment and an emphasis on a post-millennial reform theology that denounces this interpretation of Matthew 24 and this interpretation of the fig tree. Because in this Reformed theology, there's no place for national Israel and prophecy because national Israel has been replaced by the church. This is an old interpretation found in Roman Catholicism and was carried over into early Protestantism. Even John Calvin in the 1500s, in his commentary on Matthew 24:32, he saw the point that there were to be signs preceding the second coming of Christ, but he interpreted the fig tree bringing forth leaves as a revival of the church, or in the church, before the return of Christ. You know, at this time, the Jewish people were an insignificant minority. They weren't even considered as playing any future role. But in the 20th century, these scriptures were reconsidered, and the role of future Israel and prophecy was understood. But in this new reform movement, the writings of the reformers and the Puritans are highly regarded. So whatever they said about prophecy is considered more authoritative because Calvin or Luther said it. You know, I just find that this revival in replacement theology in gospel preaching churches is quite peculiar. Now, on the part of some evangelicals, they oppose Israel because they're woke. They're going along with the spirit of the age. So they go along to get along with the anti-Jewish, pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas position on the left. That the land now belongs to the Muslims, to the Arabs, and not to the Jews. And so therefore, the Jews have no right to build a country in the land taken by the Arabs. I also wonder if this new generation of evangelicals are simply reacting or rebelling against the position of the older generation, just to be contrarian, you know, the typical pride of youth. Or it could be the typical theological hubris slipping into evangelicalism, that has slipped into mainstream Protestantism, where a literal interpretation of prophecy is not intellectual enough, it's not sophisticated enough, it's not nuanced enough, and this is often the gateway to liberalism in the church. Or this rise in anti-Zionism could be a reaction against many televangelists and many pro-Israeli ministries that have over-aggrandized the Jews, singing the praises of national Israel and failing to point out that they are enemies of the gospel. Romans chapter 11, verse 28, from the standpoint of the gospel, they are enemies for your sake. But from the standpoint of God's choice, they are beloved for the sake of the fathers. So notice the tension and the paradox. The new reform movement may be reacting to this error of falsely painting out the Jews to be a super spiritual people. As these new Christians are learning that unsaved Jews in the 20th century have been very instrumental in promoting the cultural rot. But let me suggest that these reformed ministries have swung the pendulum too far in the other direction. So that given the Jewish immorality and falsehoods, they can't fathom the Jews could have any function in God's prophetic plan. Now, let me separate between the new reform movement and leftist evangelicals. Given the rise of anti-Jewish attitudes and reform movement, some of their leaders put out the Antioch Declaration, rebuking those who were anti-Semitic and Holocaust deniers in their ranks. The reform movement, in its various levels of replacement theology, is not such a false teaching threat to the church. But leftist evangelicalism that sides with Hamas is dangerous. The bottom line is that the revival of the State of Israel is a biblical sign of Christ's return. Pay attention to the Jews returning to the land. And this brings me to my second point, and a text of scripture that many Christians are unaware of. Point number two, Israel is unclean. God is bringing them back to the land, not as a godly spiritual people, but as those in rebellion to God. And once back in the land, God will put them into his pressure cooker so that a remnant will return to Christ, a final harvest among the physical sons of Israel in the last days. Daniel chapter 11, verse 35, some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and to make them pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. Zechariah chapter 13, verse 9, and I will bring the third part through the fire, refine them as silver is refined, and test them as gold is tested. They will call on my name, and I will answer them, and I will say, they are my people, and they will say, the Lord is my God. Now, one of the questions that comes up in regard to Israel is how can they be blessed by God militarily, financially? There are more Nobel Prize winners per population in Israel than any other nation. And just look how they defeated Iran. A nation of 7 million Jews defeated a nation of 90 million Muslims. And this fuels conspiracy theories that the Jews are operating a secret cabal to take over the world. And these conspiracy theories are very popular in the Islamic world. And this is how it works. The Muslims believe they have the final word of God, the Quran. And believing that they are the people of God, they really can't explain why the Jews are so successful. And they're unwilling to say that the Jews are blessed of God. So the only other explanation is that the Jews must be gaming the system. They must be in league with Satan or be part of a secret cabal running the world for the benefit of the Jews. They must be cheating. So that's why they're so successful. And this was also the justification for anti-Semitism in Germany after World War I. Now, from an evangelical point of view, often evangelicals see that the Jews are blessed and conclude it must be because the Jews are righteous before God. But neither view is correct. The answer for the current blessing upon the Jews in their return from the diaspora is found in the prophet Haggai chapter 2. Haggai was God's prophet to the Jews when they returned from the Babylonian exile to rebuild Jerusalem and the temple, 530 BC. Haggai's message from God was that the Jews should rebuild the temple. Chapter 2, verse 10, the word of the Lord came to Haggai the prophet, saying, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, ask now the priest for a ruling. If a man carries holy meat in the fold of his garment and touches bread with his fold, or cooked food, wine, oil, or any other food, will it become holy?" The priests answered, "No." Then Haggai said, "If one who is unclean from a corpse touches any of these, will the latter become unclean?" And the priests answered, "It will become unclean." Now, this is an obscure text, but it packs a powerful message. Haggai is referring back to the law of Moses concerning physical defilement when one touches that which is unclean, such as a dead body. The point is that spiritual moral contamination only works one way. That which is unclean defiles that which is holy, but that which is holy doesn't cleanse that which is unclean. And it works this way with disease. If a sick person enters a room, he will contaminate the healthy. But if a healthy person enters into a room of sick people, he doesn't heal the sick. What's the spiritual lesson? Our righteousness cannot take away or cover sins. Sin needs to be removed by God. So what's the point in Haggai's illustration? Well, verse 14. Then Haggai says, "So is this people, and so is this nation before me, declares the Lord, and so is every work of their hands, and what they offer there is unclean." Haggai is saying that the Jewish people are ungodly, and so therefore, the works of their hands are unacceptable. And the work in view is the construction of the second temple itself. This certainly helped the people realize that they were not being blessed because of their own righteousness. Just as Moses told the people when they exited Egypt, Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 5, "It's not for your righteousness or for the uprightness of your heart that you're going to possess the land of the Canaanites." Now, Haggai goes on to describe how before the rebuilding of the temple, the Jews were cursed because of their sin. Verse 15, "But now do consider from this day onward, before one stone was placed upon another in the temple of the Lord, from that time when one came to a grain heap of 20 measures, there would only be 10. And when one came to a wine vat to draw 50 measures, there would only be 20. I smote you and every work of your hands with blasting wind and mildew and hail, yet you did not come back to me, declares the Lord." So what Haggai is describing are the terms of the Old Covenant, Deuteronomy chapter 28. If you disobey the Lord your God, cursed you shall be in the city, cursed shall you be in the country, cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl, cursed shall be the offspring of your body and the produce of your ground, the increase of your herd, and the young of your flock. Cursed shall you be when you come in, and cursed shall you be when you go out. God is serious about his law, and he doesn't grade on a curve. Galatians chapter 3, verse 10, "Cursed is everyone who does not abide by all things written in the book of the law to perform them." So God wasn't looking at the Jews as relatively righteous and religious compared to the surrounding Gentiles. They were just as unsaved. But here's the great surprise. God goes on to say that he will now bless them, not because they're righteous, but bless them even in their uncleanness. Verse 18, do consider from this day onward and from the 24th day of the ninth month, from the day when the temple of the Lord was founded, consider, is the seed still in the barn, even including the vine, the fig tree, the pomegranate, and the olive tree? It has not borne fruit. Yet from this day on, I will bless you. This is actually a contradiction and a violation of the Mosaic covenant. If they're unclean, God cannot bless them. So why are they blessed? Well, the text goes on to explain that God's purpose is to establish Israel for the purpose of bringing in the Messiah. God will fulfill his promise by grace despite the people. And here's the big takeaway. The same situation is being repeated today in the rebuilding of Israel and the return of the Jews in this second diaspora. The Jews aren't righteous, but they're being blessed to set up the nation for another harvest of souls and the return of the Messiah. This is so contradictory to the works righteousness of Judaism that the rabbis have put a spin on Haggai chapter 2, verse 14. They teach that the nation that's before me is not referring to the Jews, but the Samaritans who are occupying the land. It's the Samaritans who are unclean. They are the ones who have been removing the blessing of God on the work of the temple, because the Jews in their self-righteousness would never admit that they were unclean. Have you noticed anti-Israeli, ultra-Orthodox Jews and Hasidic Jews in America? They show up and they protest right alongside Muslim Palestinians against Israel. How can this be? Because in their self-righteousness, they despise any Jews who are not of their variety of orthodoxy. So therefore, anything that less orthodox Jews accomplish cannot be accepted. It's rejected. It's despised. If those non-orthodox Jews are successful in rebuilding Israel, it can't be of God. And we often see this, the same kind of jealousy in evangelicalism, that those other evangelicals who are not deemed to be fundamentalist enough can't be used of God. That the ultra-Orthodox Jews in their self-righteousness are against the program of God should not come as a surprise to us, because it's the same reason they rejected Jesus. And remember, Jesus had a wider ministry, not with the Jews in Jerusalem and Judea, the more Orthodox Jews, but the more secularized Jews in Galilee. And remember, the Jews in Jerusalem would say, can any good thing come from Nazareth, Galilee? And being called a Galilean was a mockery. It's actually the less Orthodox Jews, the less self-righteous, who are more open to the program of God and even the gospel of Jesus Christ. And this is where most of the converts among the Jews are coming from. In Israel today, there are three groups. First, the left-leaning secular Jews. And these are the Jews in Tel Aviv who have their gay pride parades and their pro-abortion. These were the Jews who protested Netanyahu's conservative party in the spring of 2023. The conservatives wanted to rein in the power of the Israeli courts, because like in the United States, the courts in Israel have become the tool that the left has used to legalize abortion and homosexuality and homosexual marriage and transgenderism and socialism, because these leftist Jewish judges are unbelievers and they base their morals on human freedom. If you followed the news last week, you noticed Trump's reaction to the movement in Israel to prosecute Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu is currently on trial in Israel, facing charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. And the trial was supposed to start this week. just like the left in America fabricated charges against Trump and tried to use lawfare to take him down, the left in Israel is using the same strategy against the conservative Netanyahu, using lawfare. And the Prime Minister Netanyahu is in the middle of a war for the survival of Israel, and the left is prosecuting him. But after Trump's threats, the court in Israel decided to postpone the trial. But the left in Israel still wants to eventually destroy Netanyahu. So that's the evil left in Israel. But then there are the ultra-Orthodox Jews who stand at the Wailing Wall. And they pray and they study the Torah. Until recently, they were exempt from military service, but that has changed. And so many ultra-Orthodox are protesting the conservative government. Then there's the third group, the conservative Jews, who are generally theistic and have some patriotic loyalty toward Israel and believe in the nation of Israel. And these are the Jews who are most open to the gospel and most welcoming to the Christians. And as God has had a harvest among the Jewish people in the first century, God will have a harvest among the Jewish people at the end of this age. So I've only covered two of the 8 points, which means that this might be a three-part series. First, what is happening in Israel is a prophetic sign. Pay attention to Israel. And second, Israel is being blessed despite Israel being spiritually unclean and unsaved. And evangelicals must be careful not to fall into the theological error of self-righteousness like the ultra-Orthodox Jews. And hence, also reject the program of God for Israel and reject Zionism out of sanctimonious pride. As Paul writes in Romans chapter 11, verse 18, "Do not be arrogant against the natural branches of Israel, and do not become conceited, but fear." I am thrilled, and I hope you are also, in watching what God is doing in this world to reestablish the nation of Israel. It is a work of God. Thanks for listening. Be in the Word every day. I hope these Bible studies are helpful in that regard. Subscribe, like, share, leave a comment below, and may Jesus Christ reign.